a commercial-free, streaming on-demand presentation from WBPN.
And I think part of what New Power Generation was about was Prince sort of cleaning the slate.
And I mean, you know, that whole Diamond and Pearl era, it was just nasty, funky, greasy, you name it.
You hit the play button and it was cream. He said, well, what do you think? And I'm like, dude, that's it. This is it. It's time for you to go to the wire. You will hit. Cause you got the burning desire. It's your time. You got the horns, so why don't you blow it?
Hello and welcome to The Story of Diamonds and Pearls, an audio documentary about Prince and the creation of his chart-topping 1991 album. I'm your host, Andrea Swenson. I'm a music journalist in Prince's hometown of Minneapolis. And over the next hour, we are going to turn the clocks back to the early 90s to learn more about how Prince emerged from the 80s, a decade he conquered musically and culturally, and worked to completely redefine his sound and his style for a new era. This will be the day that you will hear me say that I will never run. This is the era of his hit song Cream going to number one, of Prince performing Get Off in those famous yellow lace butt-out pants on the MTV VMAs, and of that luxurious title track Diamonds and Pearls that so prominently featured the force of nature, Rosie Gaines. Which one of us is right? This was what Prince's staff described as his yellow period, one where he requested that everything channel his two favorite movies at the time, Godfather 3 and Barbarella, and one that seemed rooted in a newfound commitment to shattering genre barriers and spreading positivity, all with the help of a new band, the New Power Generation, who had been mostly handpicked by Prince from his own hometown music scene. To learn more about this era, you're going to hear from the founding members of the New Power Generation, or NPG, in their words. And we're going to take a first listen to some of the previously unreleased music coming out of Prince's vault this fall. Like this song, Something Funky, This House Comes. Ooh, yeah, keep running like that, yeah. Ooh, yeah, who that said that we can't jam? Ooh, yeah, keep running like that, yeah. Ooh, yeah. You'll also get to hear the band's reactions as they revisit this material, a lot of which they haven't heard since they recorded it with Prince in the early 90s.
You're bringing me way back. Now I'm just like going, oh yeah, I remember that. Oh, dang.
That's all coming up on The Story of Diamonds and Pearls, an audio documentary produced in collaboration with NPG Records, Paisley Park Enterprises, Sony Music Entertainment, and Warner Records. To begin, I want to get into what this band, the New Power Generation, meant to Prince. Listening to that recording of Something Funky, This House Comes is a great introduction to this particular group of people, because you can hear Tony Mosley there calling out many of the founding members of the NPG and talking about their incredible talents. It was a big deal that the NPG were co-credited on Diamonds and Pearls alongside Prince. It was the first time Prince had done that since the Revolution, and it signaled the start of a new era. The new power generation would grow and shrink and evolve into many different iterations throughout the rest of Prince's career. Eventually, the letters NPG came to symbolize Prince's prowess as a band leader in the live setting, more than it had to do with any specific group of musicians. But in the beginning, Prince was on a mission to assemble a band who could help him reinvent himself for a new decade. And as the 80s came to a close, he started plucking musicians out of the clubs in his own hometown.
Hi, Andrea. My name is Michael Bland. I worked for Prince consistently from sometime in 1989 through 1996.
Michael Bland was the first new musician that Prince brought on board for what would soon become the new power generation. I love Michael's story about Prince scouting him when he was just an 18-year-old college student.
Starting in 1987, I took over drumming for Dr. Mambo's Combo at Bunkers, which is still an institution here, Sundays instead of Mondays now, every Sunday night. And I think what happened was Prince got off the Love Sexy tour and basically just was like, not fired everybody, but he kind of was just disengaged. Like it was over. He was ready to do something else.
This is something that I also heard from one of the musicians who continued on from the Love Sexy era with Prince, Levi Caesar Jr.
So there was this idea kind of floating around like a bad ghost, the tour wasn't successful. And the whole band was scratching their head. And what happened for a short period of time is we were taken off retainer. And during that time, I think, some of the band members were like, well, I don't know what's really going on, so maybe this is the time that I should make an exit.
Following the Love Sexy tour, which wrapped up in February 1989, the dancer Cat Glover, the singer and keyboardist Bonnie Boyer, and the drummer Sheila E. all left Prince's live band.
Obviously, I stayed. And I was the music director, so Prince is like, well, it looks like most of the people are gone. So you got to put another band together. So that's when I started, looking for the new players that were the version of the new power generation that I was in. We started with found Michael Bland.
He heard about me from Margaret Cox. He saw the Combo doing a gig at the Fine Line on a Wednesday, but with a different drummer because I had another job across town. And Prince recognized Margaret as the lead singer of Tamara and the Scene. And so on the break, I guess he invited her out to the limo to have a conversation. And he said, wow, you guys have a really great band. And she was like, oh, yeah, thanks. This is not our normal drummer, but you should hear, you should hear us again with our regular drummer. This kid, he's like 17. And, I was probably 18 at the time. And, he's, oh, yeah. So the next Monday, here comes Prince with like probably half of the band, like dressed in full regalia, walking into Bunkers, And he found like a cubby hole in like a booth in back by the popcorn machine and kind of, just sat up on top of the booth so he could see what was going on. And I kind of peeked my head out and I see him and our eyes meet and he kind of waves. And so I put my drink down and I go out to meet him. We start talking. Later on, he decides to sit in with the band. And I just kind of was like, I'm just going to not even really pay attention to him. I'm just going to do what I do,
Michael was incredible. I'm like, I can't believe this guy is here at Bunkers. And I knew, I'm like, that's the guy. Now I got to convince Prince, though.
And then one night, we're finishing up at Bunkers, and he sends a security down to invite us out to a party he's having for John Bon Jovi. How was the gig tonight? Oh, yeah, it was good, man. And you're worn out or you feel like playing a little more. So we jump on, the instruments that are set up and we start kind of just funking, And Prince is looking and he's like, like he's digging what's going on. And he's just on the microphone while he's playing, he said, hey, you looking for a job, son? And I was like, yeah, ha ha. That's very funny. 2 days later, he calls my house and, you know, asks my dad, may I speak to Michael, please? You know, and I'm at that point a student at Augsburg. So he's like, hey, you know, I'm calling to ask if you want to join my band. I said, well, I've been going to college, and like, do you think I'll have time to finish my fall semester? And he just starts cracking up because he realizes I have no idea what's on the table. And he says, I think you might be a little too busy to do that.
By the end of the summer, Michael was flown to LA to shoot his first music video with Prince, Party Man, from the Batman soundtrack. And he would make his television debut performing in front of millions on the 15th anniversary of Saturday Night Live. As Michael adjusted to his new star-studded reality, he realized he had a lot to learn.
You know, I was young, I was greenhorn, and everybody really pitched in and helped me kind of, you know, gain an understanding of not just what the job was, but just how to hang. You know, you're talking about somebody who has conquered the world, took the 1980s as a decade and had his way with it. You could engage him in conversation, you know, but really, you're not there for that. It's a lot like the army. It's like, well, where's the commissary? You follow the hungry soldiers. So a lot of it was that, like, keep your eyes open and your mouth shut. And, you know, he would still engage me sometimes because I had questions. I was a young person, never been nowhere, never done anything. I would inquire. And sometimes I realized in retrospect that I was really tap dancing on his last nerve. And I never really got to thank him for that because I really just kind of, you know, I'd ask him like, oh, do you know what time the flight is tomorrow? And he's thinking about whatever it is he has to deal with at Warner Brothers, you know, and, you know, and I'm, you know, 18, 19, you know, hey, and he turned around and I could tell you, he kind of, you know, took a breath first. So, you know, he never really just broke out and said, do you know who you are talking to? I've conquered the world that you live in. Don't you understand who I am? He never did that, you know, and he had real license to do so.
Where Michael really shined was alone in the studio with Prince, where the two could communicate on a much deeper level through the music. Their connection was obvious to them both.
A lot of the early recording I did with him was just me and him. He'd be playing piano and I'd be playing the drums, and you know, I'd hang around and watch him just go from bass to guitar to keyboards and just build the track. And we would just talk and get acquainted during those times. Those times are the ones that I cherish the most with him, because it's like we're two people having a conversation. And I got more time with him that way than a lot of people did.
Here we go. Me and Levi start, and then you come in with big... Okay, Gary, ready? 1, 2, 3,
a recording from Prince's vault titled Dark Side, which features Michael on drums and Levi Cesar on bass. It's one of the earlier demos included in the Diamonds and Pearls Super Deluxe set. You can hear how Prince is gently guiding Michael and encouraging him, playing the role of teacher as well as band leader, and getting him ready to start recording a mountain of new material.
Some of the songs we ended up recording in studios around the world ended up being the seeds that were planted for Diamonds and Pearls. The basic rhythm track for Willing and Able was probably the first of it. But we recorded that and the basic for Money Don't Matter Tonight. The same session in Japan, in Tokyo. Sony has a recording studio. And so those two things happened. Oh, also Strollin' was recorded during that session. These would have been that towards the end of the tour because we did Europe first and then we went to Japan.
As we know, Prince wasn't one to sit around telling his band, or anyone for that matter, what he was up to in any given moment. But an interview he gave to Neil Carlin for a Rolling Stone cover story in 1990 offered a unique glimpse into the early stages of his work on Diamonds and Pearls. Speaking to Neil backstage at one of his European nude tour shows in August 1990, Prince produced what the writer described as a crinkled dime store notebook that he carries with him like Linus's blanket. Empty when the tour started in May, the book is nearly full with 21 new songs scripted in perfect grammar school penmanship. Songs were pouring out of Prince that summer, which is why he'd started booking studio time and recording demos, even while he was simultaneously juggling the editing of Graffiti Bridge and performing big arena shows. This is another demo that Prince recorded with Michael and Levi during that prolific summer. It's called Lorianne. Interestingly, Prince would revisit the song 3 years later while working on the Undertaker project with Michael and Sonny T. And Michael had completely forgotten that they recorded this earlier version.
Let me tell you something. This is not the version of Lorianne that I'm familiar with. I'm not saying that's not me playing, but I don't recognize that. We had played some musical idea, and he must have turned it into, you know, he used the lyrics. This is what I'm saying. I did an interview with Mobeen Azar from the BBC. We wanted to know what's in the vault. I said, well, mostly it's a lot of songs that you know already, but different versions. Like, there's very few songs that, you know, Prince just started and finished. All sorts of things had different reincarnations.
Listen to more music from Prince's vault and talk about how Prince found his powerhouse vocalist from this era, Rosie Gaines, coming up next on The Story of Diamonds and Pearls.
You're listening to 92.9 and 96.5 WBPM, presenting a mashup of all the biggest hits of all time and the Hudson Valley's best commercials. And you better pay attention because there just might be a quiz at the end of this hour.
Welcome back to The Story of Diamonds and Pearls, an audio documentary about Prince and the creation of his chart-topping 1991 album. Before the break, we were talking about the formation of Prince's band, the New Power Generation, who are co-credited on Diamonds and Pearls. Even before the band was solidified, Prince had started talking about this concept of a new power generation in his songwriting.
Generation, we want to change the world. The only thing that's in our way is
The track New Power Generation appeared on the soundtrack for Prince's 1990 film Graffiti Bridge. It was one of the first Prince recordings to include vocals from Rosie Gaines, who would become a central member of the NPG. Levi Caesar, who was Prince's musical director in this era, remembers orchestrating that first meeting between Prince and Rosie.
I flew out to the Bay, talked to Rosie, and then I flew her back with me. Prince said, okay, he didn't want to meet her first until he actually heard her sing. So I said, well, what do you want to do? He said, well, I wrote a couple of songs. Have her sing those songs, then bring it back to me, and then I'll decide if I want to meet her. And I'm like, oh, this is just a piece of cake here.
Rosie Gaines also remembers this interaction well.
It all started with Levi Caesar. I was in a band called Curtis Olsen Band. And Levi was a guitar player of Curtis Olsen. And so he took Levi from Curtis, yeah. And then Prince took Levi from Sheila E. And then he left me in the studio with Levi, and we recorded that song, I Want You. Remember that song, I Want You? Mm-hmm. So we recorded that in the studio, and then so we had fun with that, and then he went to see if he liked it.
Prince was in his apartment at Paisley. He gave me the songs. The engineer was ready, so I took Rosie in the studio. We were back in an hour. And he said, hey, what happened? It didn't work out. I said, no, we got both songs done. He said, what, in 1 hour? No way. And I'm laughing. He's like, man, let me hear this. No way. So we put the tape on. And 1 minute in, he stopped the tape. And he's like, that voice is in my studio right now? I'm like, yeah. That voice, because he felt like she was like Aretha Franklin. That voice is in my studio. You telling me that, Levi? He started dancing. He was so happy.
And then I was so excited to meet him when I finally saw him. My mouth was open a little bit. Because here it was. I was someone that watched Purple Rain about at least 5 to 6 times.
Right.
I watched that and I fell in love with Prince. So then there it was. There he was right before my face.
And then I remember before he started recording, or he said he just sat around with the piano with her. He knows all of Aretha Franklin's songs, you know, and he's playing them and Rosie's just going through it like it's water. That was a nice day. I wanted to see him happy. He was very happy, so...
This is Pain, a song that Prince and Rosie first worked on together in July 1990 during the Nude Tour.
I liken our love to a gentle fire. If I get too close, then I'll get burned. Enough, and I'll be one man's a little baby. How come you just can't give me what I earn? I don't know.
In those early days, Prince kept good on his promise to help Rosie with her solo material, in addition to showcasing her in his band. While Prince was in the midst of a multi-night residency at Wembley Arena, he visited Metropolis Studios in London with Rosie and the band, including Michael Bland on drums and Dr. Fink on keys, and recorded 3 of her songs in a single day. This is Streetwalker, a song written by Rosie Gaines that has been in Prince's vaults until now.
Silk stockings, lipstick red, all the fire burning in me. Her arms are open, but her heart is cold. You got the money, soul, I to the street walker. It's just another five. Street walker, trying to stay alive. Street walker, used to be my friend. Street walker, how you gonna keep time again?
They also worked on My Tender Heart, a song that Rosie had initially written for her husband, but that Prince rewrote in the studio. He heard the song and he said, you know, this is a great song, but he did change some things around, change the lyrics around.
This is Rosie speaking to KFPA Radio in 1997.
He made the story more about a guy cheating on a woman, but the initial story was more about being in love with a guy. Let me tell you the hook. It's like, my tender heart, my tender love is all I have to give. So be careful when you say the words, I love you, be sure is what you mean. That was the initial thing. And
how did P do it?
He did. My tender heart, my tender love is all I have to give. What makes you think I can live without you? Like, what makes you think I can live without you?
What makes you think I could live without you? Without you. When I don't want to leave.
When do you feel like the NPG, like that first iteration of the NPG, really gelled?
I would say, like, after Rosie got in there. Because usually most of Prince's projects, I mean, obviously he's the main vocalist. So to have another vocalist that he would say, okay, you sing that whole song or half of that or do a duet with me, that's really altering the sound. So in my opinion, I would say once we brought Rosie in, then it's like, let's go.
Did you know that scream at the beginning of Get Off is Rosie Gaines? That's something I was so delighted to learn while working on this project. Rosie is all over Diamonds and Pearls, and Prince was clearly energized by working with her in the studio and eager to showcase her talents alongside his own.
She's the baddest. Rosie is like the second coming of Aretha Franklin. She can reach anybody. She can make anybody's spirit move. You know? And Prince knew that. She was like the secret weapon, which wasn't so secret, you know? And for him to give a singer that much room in his band, that said a lot. I mean, with all of us, he gave me a lot of real estate to work with. He was so generous with this group, you know, and it shows in the recordings, in the way he used us. It's like he just let the gifts come.
Walk on this side of the street. Don't walk where it feels the best. Walk away from people you meet. Don't talk to strangers unless they walk the way you want them to. Don't walk unless the others do.
With the new tour wrapped and new material still pouring out of Prince at a rapid pace, he turned his attention toward finalizing the lineup for his new power generation. To flesh out the band, he once again dipped into the club scene in Minneapolis.
My name's Tommy Barbarella. I was keyboardist for the new power generation from 1990 to 96.
Remember how this was Prince's Godfather 3 meets Barbarella era?
Well, Tommy was originally known as Tom Elm and was renamed by Prince. He landed on Prince's radar while playing the fine line with the gospel group The Steels, alongside one of Prince's childhood mentors and musical heroes, Sonny Thompson.
Yeah, Sonny and I played with The Steels, and that's when out here, that was Batman era, and Prince used to come down to hear us because, I mean, The Steels, but also because Sonny was in the band, so... So him and Kim Basinger would be sitting up in the table up on the edge of the second floor looking down. And everyone would be telling me, he's checking you out. Prince is checking you out. He likes your look. And I was like, yeah, right.
What was your look?
I was working it pretty hard. Very Prince-like. I was full-on makeup and crazy clothes. You know, I was doing the thing.
Tommy's story about ending up out at Paisley Park also happens to involve Dr. Mambo's Combo and Margaret Cox, the same person that had tipped Prince off to Michael Bland.
He had done a record on Margaret Cox called MC Flash, and the backing band was basically Mambo's Combo. We're right here in Studio C, rehearsing, and that's, you know, the first time I met Prince.
Tommy and I recorded this interview together in the control room of Studio C at Paisley Park, which is now home to a Purple Rain Museum exhibit. It was quite surreal to watch him look out into the studio space and travel back in time to his earliest memories there.
So it was literally after one of those rehearsals, probably second time I was here, third time maybe, that Prince asked Sonny Michael and I to stay behind and help him finish off a couple of new songs that he was working on. And it was like, are you serious?
And the idea he had was for Diamonds and Pearls. And he started showing Sonny like the do-do-do-do, showing him on the keyboard, like, I hear the bass doing this. And, you know, Sonny put his own wiggle on and he's, oh, good, okay. And then he showed the chords to Barbarella. Like, we got as far as probably the bridge. And then he went, okay, if you guys can stay for another half an hour, we can record this right now.
Us the songs, we ended up moving our stuff over to Studio B, and we recorded Diamonds and Pearls that day.
That was the first song we did.
This is Sonny Thompson, also known as Sonny T.
He said, I got this song called Diamonds and Pearls I want to record. So I think we recorded that song in about maybe an hour. It was me, Tommy, Michael Bland, Prince was playing. And I hadn't met Rosie yet. It was just us at first, you know. And then Levi came in. I think he cut his guitar to play, if I remember correctly. And that's how it all really started for me.
We did two takes. The only difference between the two takes is, well, there's two differences. I changed the kick drum pattern in the third verse a little to be a little less obtrusive. And also that hole at the end of the fanfare, I put something in there, you know? It needs something. Okay. So second pass, you know, I'm the entire time we're playing, I'm like, what am I gonna do in this huge hole? Well, it's a bar long and needs a drum fill. So I just open up the Google. I do the thing. Prince is looking from the control room. All right. Yeah. He's happy. You know, things went quick, went smooth. Barbarella did a couple of overdubs, and we had it out.
Everyone still had gigs to play that night. Michael headed to Bunkers to play with Mambo's Combo, and Tommy and Sonny went to another bar in the Warehouse District called Nikki's Cafe.
I was playing piano down at Nikki's. Remember Nikki's Cafe? The goat cheese pizza. I think I played down there in that upright, but Sonny was with me. And I remember playing, and we were like, oh, let's play that song we recorded today with Prince. And we would play Diamonds and Pearls. Like, I thought it was maybe a Christmas song.
Prince was so energized by the way the Diamonds and Pearls recording had gone that he sent out for all three musicians to come back to Paisley Park.
About 12:30, Dwayne, his brother, shows up, head of security. Hey, Prince said he wants you guys to come back to the studio after you finish up down here. So we go back. We cut another song for Diamonds and Pearls called Live for Love.
Keep going. This is an early version of Live for Love from Prince's Vault.
I remember him and Sheila E. Sheila E. was there that day, too.
He was sitting in the control room with Sheila, and I was, like, doubly nervous because she was there, too. And I'm like, oh, my God, that's Sheila E. And he's like, take a solo. And so, like, that solo ended up on Live for Love.
Prince clearly liked what he heard. In the album mix of the song, he can be heard egging Tommy on.
But yeah, all that stuff happened really fast, and that was before I was even in the band. For me, it was just like, oh my God, I can't believe this is happening. A, B, I have to not screw up, and I'm, you know, got to perform. And then C, I have to try to look really cool doing it all the time. And that was the pressure that never ended, really.
You know, it turned into an official offer for Tommy and Sonny to join the band. And we cut most of that record as a rhythm section in the studio, which people weren't really doing at that time.
The recording process really was great after that.
Yeah.
That album, it just started flowing, you know, the Diamonds and Pearls record and then all the other Prince albums after that. You know, we just started spitting out so much music. It was just an amazing time in history for him because he felt that he had a lot of guys he knew that he grew up with.
I love that it's so Minneapolis. Like he's really minding his own hometown, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. It's totally a Minneapolis thing, you know? And he just felt free because it was all his friends.
Coming up next on the story of Diamonds and Pearls.
Minneapolis is a feel, you know? You can tell the difference.
We are going to dig deeper into Prince's roots in his hometown of Minneapolis, and you're going to meet the dancing, rapping, drumming, singing trio of Tony Mosley, Damon Dixon, and Kirk Johnson, who you may know as TDK or the Game Boys, and who became a central force in Prince's world during the Diamonds and Pearls era.
When you're in your 30s, you would go out to 6 bars in one night. When you're in your 40s, you would go out to 1 bar and be in bed by midnight. These days, you're drinking at home and comparing fruit prices at grocery stores online. But at least you've got great music to listen to while you're doing it all. Thanks for making what we do worth our time. 92.9 and 96.5 WBPM.
Step one, step on to the dance floor. Welcome back to the story of Diamonds and Pearls, an audio documentary about Prince and the formation of his legendary band, the New Power Generation. We've already met several of the core musicians who appeared on Diamonds and Pearls with Prince, and now we're going to get to know Tony Mosley, heard rapping on this track Push, along with his fellow dancing dynamos Damon Dixon and Kirk Johnson. In addition to acting as Prince's onstage foils in this era, Tony, Damon, and Kirk's involvement further roots the NPG in Prince's hometown. They all grew up alongside Prince, Sonny T, and other Minneapolis sound luminaries like Terry Lewis, Jerome Benton, Morris Day, and Andre Simone in the relatively small, tight-knit community of North Minneapolis in the 70s. Speaking to Rolling Stone in 1990, Prince said, People talk about Minneapolis sound or Minneapolis scene, but they don't really know what the place looks like or means. I want it to mean something. And after talking to all of these talented Northsiders, I've come to the conclusion that you can't fully understand what Prince was doing with his new power generation without understanding the vibrant Black community that shaped him when he and his peers were just teenagers.
That's that Northside swagger. Don't let it fool you.
This is Tony Mosley, who Prince called Tony M.
So I grew up in North Minneapolis, grew up watching Prince and them doing the Battle of the Bands in Phyllis Wheatley Park. Back in the day, Spike Moss used to put together this big summertime festival, right?
That festival Tony is referring to was an extension of the Way Community Center in North Minneapolis, which had a music program led by the educator and activist Spike Moss. The Way was a safe space for Black youth in the neighborhood, and it was created in the aftermath of two summers of civil unrest in the 1960s.
I mean, that's when Broadway Avenue just kind of burned down, you know what I mean? Because it was just so much civil unrest going on. And again, Spike having that, and it wasn't big. The Way, it was a small little, almost a cube that sat in the middle of Plymouth Avenue that, you know, he would allow these cats to come in and rehearse and just to be off of the streets. And yeah, that's where a lot of people honed their crafts, or woodshed, as we would say.
The dynamic Tony is describing here is key to understanding how Minneapolis shaped this whole generation of young Black artists. This idea of pursuing creative freedom in oppressive circumstances, and of creating your own world if the one that you're living in doesn't accept you. Well, it's easy to see how this all shaped Prince's worldview and influenced his creativity.
I think that's where a lot of his pain came from, and just his matter-of-factness. As he was talking or spitting lyrics, it was the time that they grew up in. It was their reality, right? It was their truth.
If I had a time machine, I would totally go back to the summer of 1975 and attend one of those Battle of the Band showcases on the North Side. I mean, can you imagine? Prince and his bandmates Andre Simone and Morris Day playing in Grand Central, Jimmy Jam playing with his soul group Mind and Matter, Terry Lewis leading the ferocious horn-heavy funk band Flight Time, and Sonny T holding court with his experimental funk rock band The Family. Sonny was just a few years older than everyone else, and he was regarded as a mentor and a guiding light for this whole generation of talented young kids.
Prince always talked to me about Sonny.
This is NPG guitarist Levi Caesar Jr.
He says this guy named Sonny Thompson, he said, I looked up to Sonny when I was young because Sonny was, he was the musical genius in the neighborhood. So he taught Prince a lot of his musical knowledge when he was young.
In early 1991, when he was getting ready to introduce the new power generation to the world, Prince took the unusual step of writing the press release himself. And much of what he wrote about was how much he admired Sonny. Also new in the band is Prince's musical idol, Sonny T, Prince wrote. Sonny served as a role model for, written as the number four, of course, Prince, growing up in North Minneapolis. Self-taught, Sonny can play or sing anything he hears, soul, jazz, classical, anything.
He wrote that?
Yeah, he did.
Prince wrote that?
He did.
Really? Oh, my God. And I have no idea, you know, it was that deep for him, you know. That. But, you know, we were always friends.
Sonny and Prince met through the Way when they were both still in high school.
Yeah, he was staying with me for a while.
Right.
And we would just stay up all night making all kinds of noise at my mom's house, and she would get mad. And Sonny, you and Prince need to go to bed.
That's like, so cute. It'd
be 6 a.m. and we're listening to Quincy Jones records and everything, and we're just playing all night.
Another musician who vividly remembers being inspired by The Family and who would end up joining Prince and Sonny in the NPG is the dancer and drummer Kirk Johnson.
I played with Sonny as a youngin. I was playing percussion in the band The Family, which he...
You were?
Oh, yeah. I was a percussionist.
I didn't know that.
And my sister sang.
Yeah, he was really, he was a baby. I got a picture of him. About 9 or 10 years old.
Wow.
And he was in our band. I've been knowing Kurt forever.
The more I talk to Prince's bandmates, the more I realize that literally half the musicians who would end up in the New Power Generation were all hanging out in close proximity to one another back in the 70s, attending concerts held outside the community centers and on the football fields of North Minneapolis. Digging further into this history, I learned that those football fields were also where Tony Mosley and his future crewmates were first inspired to dance.
I got with Damon Dixon, so Damon and I used to kind of have dance-offs at North Commons Park.
After graduating from North High, and after Tony enlisted and served in the Marines, he ended up reconnecting with Damon.
Tony came to me. We were living in the same apartment complex. He's like, hey, you used to dance. You still dance? I was like, yeah. He said, we should go down to First Avenue and check out their dance contest. And I was like, really? He said, yeah, man, they have it every week.
So Damon and Tony was winning every week. Then we came and we started winning. This is how it happened. If you won the contest, you were able to be an extra in Purple Rain. So we won, you know, Tony and Damon had won, the guys had won. And then during the filming of the movie, again, we all end up, you know, hanging out and dancing together.
Thinking this was their big break into Prince's world, the dancers created routines for many of the songs from Purple Rain and gave it their all over several days of filming. When it came time for the movie to come out, however, they realized that only a small snippet of their dancing could be seen in the final cut of the film.
But, you know, it was enough to say, hey, that's us right there, those five guys in the silhouette.
That name, Purple Rain Dancer, stuck with us from everybody. And so we were going around the city as the Purple Rain Dancers.
Tony, Damon, and Kirk kept dancing together, eventually renaming themselves Split Level and later TDK. They stayed on Prince's radar, too. They said he would invite them to perform at various parties and events over the years, and even hired them to appear in some of the videos for his side project, Madhouse. As with so many of the stories we've heard about this era, when it came time for Prince to start putting together the group that would become the NPG, he looked to his own hometown for talent, and Tony, Damon, and Kirk finally got that big break.
When he was doing Graffiti Bridge, is kind of when it first happened. We were asked to, you know, be a part of that band during that time.
I think originally it started out also as Kirk coming on board to be a DJ, which was odd because I don't think Kirk had ever spun a turntable in his life. But you know what? He was going to take that opportunity, and I can't be mad at him. You figure it out. We got a call, I think, the next day, and it was like, you know, the press wants all you guys to come on out. And we came out. He discussed what he was trying to do. We were getting ready to form a new band. He wanted to call it the New Power Generation. He wanted to have us as dancers in that band.
It was after the movie that it kind of morphed into, well, we did Graffiti Bridge. Now we're going to tour. You guys are in the band. This is what you're going to do. It just kind of morphed into it. I mean, everything kind of happened organically around here. It wasn't like planned. And it was more like just his feel in spontaneousness. And we were just happened to be in the right place at the right time.
While on the Nude Tour with Prince in the summer of 1990, Tony had a pivotal interaction that would not only change his life, but would also influence the direction of the new music Prince was writing at the time.
I believe I was running a sound check, and we happened to be just kind of grooving. We had pretty much ran through sound check, but I had a guitar, and Kirk was on drums or something, and we were doing Humpty Dance. We went into Humpty Dance. And Prince walked in while we were doing that. And we didn't even know because he came through the back of the arena and came right up to the soundboard. And all of a sudden we just heard, yeah, can we get to a regular sound check now? And we're like, oh, shoot, he caught us.
Prince clearly liked what he heard. He asked to speak to Tony before the show.
And I went to the dressing room and just said, hey, I didn't know that. I knew you played some guitar, but not a lot. But I didn't know you did vocals and you write. Do you write raps too? I said, yeah, absolutely. He said, well, listen, during one of our breaks, my wardrobe changes. And what can you guys go into Humpty Dance? You think you could perform it? And I was, you know, the North Sider in me was like, hell yeah, I'll knock that out.
time is now, take your chance, get on top. You will cop when it takes all ass with dance to the rhythm of the cream beat. Never will you see me drowning in a pool of self-pity. So as I ooze with the flow, we're going, if you give me an inch, I'll take a little more. The army of the bunches shall overcome, bringing a crash from the drums.
Much to Tony's surprise, as soon as the band returned from the new tour, Prince started calling him into the studio at Paisley Park to contribute verses to his new songs. This is Things Have Got to Change, a hip-hop reimagining of the song Cream.
Never in a million years did I think Prince would incorporate rap into his music. When he talked about it, you know, we had real conversations. Prince, I don't know. A big chunk of your fans are not going to dig this at all. Then I'm going to have the hip hop community who's not going to dig this at all because of some of your previous records, like the Black Album, for instance. We had some negative comments about hip hop and rap at the time. And, you know, he said something to me one time. He said, listen, a lot of the artists that are out there right now in the hip hop community, if I tapped them and gave them an opportunity, they would jump on it in a heartbeat. They wouldn't even think about it. So you don't think about it. This is your role. This is your opportunity. This is your role. And I want you to shine in this role. So he just kept pushing me out more and more out front, giving me more and more opportunities. That's when we started to do a lot of recording, right? You know, he would allow me to just get in and create. And where he took it was, you know, mind-blowing, to be honest with you.
Tony's confident, breezy rapping is heard throughout Diamonds and Pearls.
On umbrella, swing low to the tempo as I flow on a roll. Here we go, willing and able, start the show right with that type of hype. I'll lay my cards on the table tonight. Don't take me light, my flow hits you just like a lead pipe.
I'll tell you one song in particular that was a challenge. It was willing and able. The cadence was hard to figure out. How was I going to make this work? And when I think it eventually hit me, he fell off the chair. He loved it.
Prince was also experimenting with rapping at this time, searching for his own authentic flow. Here he is on an early version of Live for Love, before Tony added his verse.
I got hit, but I could still complete the mission. I flash upon my own father long ago wishing before he died that I would always try to live for love.
I would hear him on a lot of things like this, and he would just ask me what I thought. And, you know, me being me, I'd say, well, man, you know, you stay on them instruments and you keep singing them vocals, but you leave the L's to me, right? And he would just laugh. I said, just the delivery is different, right? The cadence is different. Even in the more laid back style, we laugh about it all the time.
Live for love, without love you don't live. And how you make it is based on what you're giving back. In fact, only a few of us sit through the cracks. The generation, the cards, the boys, the stack, the gifts. That's the love you
don't. That playful competition between Prince and Tony can be heard especially well on the vault track The Last Dance, a spin on the Diamonds and Pearls song Jughead.
Come on, baby, dance with me. Come on, baby, take a chance with me. I'll do you real good. Ain't no other who could do the things that I would. So let's dance, understood?
Jughead.
Get up. No, no, baby, get up. Tony, no further questions. Your witness.
Bang, pow, zoom, and a whole nine. You ain't never seen another girl this fine. Pete, what you thinking?
So bad she good.
Nigga, you're crazy. You ain't never seen a future that bright.
All right, then, bed, flow, step to it. But don't you let the bright lights...
Wow, that is so crazy. Yeah, you're bringing me way back. Now I'm just like going, oh, yeah, I remember that. Oh, dang.
What was it like to be in the studio going back and forth with him like that?
Stressful. You know, he's just a perfectionist and you just don't want to look silly. You know, you want to be a professional. I did not like being in the studio. My thing is performing. I love to be on the stage. I love the instant feedback from the crowd. So the whole recording and production process for me was boring. Right. Prince used to joke when I came in, he's all ready for this long session. And I come in and it's one take and I'm out the door. So they just started calling me one take.
Sweden, we love-
love ya.
Me shed, it's easy said. Cold red, what's a new groove? Just hype for the jug, yeah, big bump. Everybody's doing the bumping. Ooh, there, I stepped up on a move. I think it's time to bust some. Please, it's cool, easy.
Is it the right one?
Yeah, this is for the hood. Better keep it greasy. Better get on a smooth tip. I don't want to sweat. I want my cement to get with this new head.
Recording the whole band live was a defining element of many of the songs on Diamonds and Pearls, and something Prince liked to bring up in this era while he was promoting the album. He saw it as a way to push back against the glossy production that had overtaken pop music and to distance himself from the computerized drum machines and synthesizers that he helped bring to the forefront in pioneering ways in the 80s. Speaking to Spin magazine in 1991, Prince said, "Everyone else went and got computers, so I threw mine away."
Yeah, I mean, that's partly true.
This is Michael Bland.
I mean, we were doing something very organic with the New Power Generation. It was like, it was real instruments. And Kirk Johnson, if there was electronic percussion, he was the one playing it. Like on Cream, that intro, the 808. That's Kirk in the room next door to me, you know. Like, that's not programming. That's not, it's, everything was in real time. We cut like Motown. Just, you know, like everybody at the same time, you know, and then Prince would go back and, you know, add whatever he wanted, you know, but you're hearing a band playing together. And that went out of style. It had gone out of style by the time Prince decided to return to it. It's like sometimes the freshest thing you can do is to go back.
I love the way Michael said that. Sometimes the freshest thing you can do is go back. I think in a lot of ways, it captures what Prince was doing in this era, joining together his earliest musical influences with the most cutting-edge sounds, reaching back into his past to build his new band, and even turning that whole idea of gangster rap on its head with gangster glam, inspired by the old-timey gangsters depicted in Godfather and mixed up with the futuristic sci-fi of Barbarella. I hope today's episode brought you closer to Minneapolis, a city that Prince loved and that deeply inspired the earliest days of the New Power Generation. As Prince himself said, performing on stage at Glam Slam in early 1992 with his new band,
"If it ain't from Minneapolis, it ain't."
You've been listening to The Story of Diamonds and Pearls, an audio documentary written, hosted, and executive produced by me, Andrea Swenson, in collaboration with NPG Records, Paisley Park Enterprises, Sony Music Entertainment, and Warner Records. Anna Wegel is our producer, and Corey Schreppel is our technical director. Special thank you to Zach Jacopo, Giancarlo Siama, and Dwayne Tudol for all their support. The newly remastered expanded editions of Diamonds and Pearls are available to order now at Prince.com. To find more Prince stories like this one, search for the Official Prince Podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or your favorite platform.